أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين اللهم صل على محمد Okay, apparently we have another week, inshallah, apart from this week. So we can somehow move with a more relaxed sort of pace and we can have more discussions on the topic. Now, you remember what we discussed last week, that the problem with Sharia and social change is society is something which is changing all the time, changing structure, and Sharia, which deals with the laws usually, should match that structure, but Sharia is fixed. So how do we overcome this? And I said that Shia jurists since about a century ago have tried to discuss and solve the problem of changing society and fixed Sharia. Now, last week we said that there are three options before us. One is that we just disregard Sharia, we say that we legislate laws according to the needs of society, based on our rational understanding. So we just discard Sharia and go for secular laws. This is what many Muslim countries have done, actually, in the past century or two. They have just started to legislate secular laws or adopt secular laws from other countries because they said it's not possible to implement the laws of Sharia. This is one opinion, which I said, of course, we cannot accept that opinion. The other opinion was that we keep the society, we contain it so that we do not need to go beyond Sharia. We keep the society inside the realm of Sharia. And this, we said, is not possible as well. It's not in our hands. Society changes without us wanting it to change. Social structure changes without us having any control on that. Because there are many things that we do which are good and recommended by Sharia, and when we put all of them together, suddenly we see that society and social structure has changed. So we cannot do anything about that. That's not the option as well. And the other option was that we try to somehow discover the areas of Sharia which have not been explored yet, and by this, in this way, we expand and push the boundaries of Sharia wider. In fact, we add to Sharia day by day, which the problem with this, can anyone tell me what is the problem with this? It's a very nice solution, actually. Very beautiful. We expand the Sharia, or we push the boundaries of Sharia to go wider. However, there's one problem with it. Anyone can tell me what is the problem with this solution? It looks very nice. Of course, we explore areas of Sharia which we have not we did not know before, and we add it to Sharia, and it becomes wider and wider, and more issues are included in Sharia. However, there is one problem. Anyone? How can we make sure that what we are adding to Sharia is actually Sharia? We may just improvise things. This is legislation of laws, isn't it? We legislate laws, and instead of saying that, okay, this is secular law, we say, this is the Sharia law. We are adding it. We are annexing it to Sharia. Is this a problem or not? So how can we solve that problem? Now, we will see. Now, how can we solve that problem? We will see. Now, the first outstanding scholar, the Shi'i jurist, who is, of course, one of the most established jurists and the most approved, acknowledged jurist in his own regard, who have discussed this, is Allama Sayyid
Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Muhammad Hussein Naini. Now, Naini was the teacher of most of the maraja of the past generation. I mean, no one could actually argue about his credentials. That's okay, you are talking about Sharia and you are not qualified to talk about Sharia. So, he was one of the jurists who had
the second option, which is considered to be supported by some Jews like Allama Naini, the second option which we discussed was that we only allow changes outside the area of Sharia. Not that we contain the society, we didn't actually bring that in at all. We contain the society so that it doesn't move, it doesn't change. Because that's impossible, so we didn't discuss it. The second option was that we bring changes to our law and legislation only outside the realm of Sharia. Now, this has a theological presupposition that there are issues which are outside the realm of Sharia. But are we taught that Sharia contains everything? Every issue of life is contained in Sharia. So, can we say that there are certain issues, certain aspects of life which are not contained in Sharia, and we can deal with it in a secular way? We don't need Sharia for that, and that's why Sharia has not been revealed in that regard. So we don't need it. There are certain aspects of life, certain areas, which we don't need Sharia to tell us what to do. In those areas, we can legislate. Now, as I said, this needs a presupposition, a theological presupposition, that there are certain areas and aspects of life which fall outside the realm of Sharia. Can you accept this? It seems we don't have mujtahids here. It's good that mujtahids, we don't want to call ourselves as mujtahids to speak in that, and because it's issue of Sharia, everyone is careful so that you are not sent to hell in the day of judgment by saying something.
Last week you mentioned the issue of traffic lights, I think. The issue of traffic lights.
That's right. Now, to talk like that about 100 years ago, was the blasphemy. You see, Naini was a very open-minded person, saying that we have aspects of life which are not related to Sharia. So we can legislate in those areas. Now remember, he wrote a book. His book was named Tanbihul Ummah wa Tanzihul Millah. That's Tanbih is reminding the Ummah and purifying the creed. That I want to tell you what is really the creed that we believe in, and I want to remind or awaken the Ummah from its slumber. Now, in his book, the book was written during the Iranian Constitutional Revolution. That's 1905 to 1911, which led to, of course, change of system in Iran from despotic to constitutional. And the main, of course, institution which was introduced was parliament. And the main dispute among ulama was whether parliament is allowed in Islam or not. Because it was a very delicate issue. It dealt with legislation. And legislation, when we talk about legislation, we always think about legislation given to us by God, Sharia. So, wouldn't Parliament oppose the idea of Sharia that we have? That legislation should come from God. No one else has authority to legislate. So, the ulama were divided. Big ulama. And we had on one side, like for example, Akhund Khorasani, the author of Kifayat al-Usul, who was backing Naini. And on the other side, we had Sayyid Muhammad Kazim al-Yazdi, the author of Urwat al-Wuthqa, who was the greatest scholar as well. They were opposing each other. So you see, it was not a simple issue to say that, okay, it's very clear, we have parliament legislating outside the realm of Sharia. These sort of distinguishing between aspects which are covered by Sharia and aspects which was not covered by Sharia was very innovative and very novel in that time. And you know, it was a big political role. Very outstanding scholars were hanged opposing this. And actually, Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri in Tehran, he was opposed to this idea, and he was hanged by people, by the constitutionalists. And of course, you see, when it comes to academic discussions, these people, of course, fight against each other, argue. But when it comes to politics, that's not the story of ulama, it was the story of people. So after Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri was hanged because of this dispute, he actually had all his books thrown into the river and said, I'm sorry that I have written this. I didn't want this to happen. This is an academic discussion. It's not something that we want to put other people's lives in danger or something like that. But you know how politics works. Now, I mentioned the opinion of Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri last week, that he was very clear. He said, you talk about legislation in parliament. What do you want to legislate? If they want to legislate laws which are in Sharia, then we have Sharia already. If they want to legislate laws outside Sharia, we are not permitted to accept it, so parliament is haram. Now, we may laugh at him now, isn't it? We may say that this is a very, of course, outmoded, very old sort of idea. However, we have to somehow give credit to people like Naini, who were so open-minded at that time, discussing this. Now, he said that he tries to prove the compatibility between modern constitutional system of government and the traditional Islamic legal and political system by, of course, his book is written in Persian. But as a Persian speaking person who has a study in Hoxha and who are a bit familiar with these jurisprudential terms, I have to read that book 3-4 times to understand what he says. He's full of jargons and absolutely written for ulama, not for ordinary people. And in that he argues based on usuli principles, on principles of jurisprudence, that we have two aspects. Aspects covered by Sharia, aspects not covered by Sharia. Now, he says that that's very interesting. They have changed form. Apparently, this machine does not accept his views, so it's changed. Now, he divides the rulings and the legal apparatus of a government into two types: the express laws of Sharia and the non-express laws, al-ahkamul mansusa. This is absolutely disappeared here. And al-ahkamul ghayrul mansusa, partly appearing. Al-Ahkam al-Mansusa are those laws which are explicitly mentioned in Sharia. And then there are other rulings in society, other aspects of society for which we need laws, but nothing in that regard has come in Sharia. So he says we have to differentiate between the two. When we come to Ahkam al-Mansusa, the express laws of Sharia, the parliament cannot intervene. They have to stop. They cannot legislate laws there. When you come to al-ahkamul ghayr al-mansusa, there are laws which are not expressed in Sharia at all, like the traffic rules, for example, or many things that nowadays we have in our society, which are completely unrelated to Sharia in their own respect. So, in those areas, the parliament can legislate. And actually, the Iranian parliament at that time was based on this opinion. They said, okay, the parliament will have 5 mujtahids. All these are actually the efforts of these people who try to make the parliament Islamic. They said the parliament, we should have 5 mujtahids in parliament, of course, chosen by the people. These 5 mujtahids are chosen by the people. They go to the parliament, but they have the right of veto. Any law legislated which these mujtahids regard to be against the express laws of Sharia, then they veto the law. So, in that way, they try to make the parliament to be something Islamic. Now, he argues that the first type are the laws of Sharia, the express laws. The express laws are laws of Sharia that cannot be violated, and the second type are the spatial, temporal-based laws, which at every juncture of time in every society we have issues which are not related to Sharia or are not discussed by Sharia, which are left to the discretion of the Islamic government and could be legislated by the parliament, provided the parliament is under the supervision of these mujtahids. Not a parliament without that supervision. So, a sort of walayatul faqih, isn't it? A sort of, because when you give right of veto to these mujtahids, that means you will have a walaya, an authority, over legislation of law. So, they say, of course, these legislations are not like fatwa of mujtahids anymore. These legislations are laws which are going to be enforced by the police, by law enforcement organs of the society. Okay? So, they need authority. And authority is the government. And the government gives authority to these mujtahids to deal with these laws. This is how, of course, the system he thought would be Islamic and also modern. According to him, all policies and measures assumed due to expediency. I think in your papers it has come right, actually. As-siyasatu naw'iyyah. That we have certain things that we have to attend to, but we don't find it in Sharia. And urged by social change fall into the second category and are within the jurisdiction of waliya amra. Now, you tell me, how does this go with the idea of marja'iyya? How can we, because this is a different type of idea of following the laws, isn't it? Yeah.
Is it possible, I mean, this is just a proposal, that you have the marja' taqlid for our day-to-day and sharia requirements, but then you also have what perhaps Mullah mentioned is marja' ummah, where you have somebody who controls the social, political, geographical requirements due to the changes, and either they can be one person or they could be a committee and work together, sort of thing.
Marja'umma, you mean wali faqih, huh?
Yeah.
Something like that.
I think where the difference lies here is that in Ayatollah Naini's case, Iran was a state.
Mm-hmm.
There are Shias who are stateless. Mm-hmm. Therefore, certain rules where he is applying category 2 or the second category may not apply
to other people in other parts of the world.
Therefore, it sort of is like, is it really the then duty of the merchant to enforce? Because we are living here, the traffic laws in the United Kingdom may not necessarily be the same as in Iran.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it then the parliament? So which parliament are we talking about here? So does the mujtahid then get involved in it?
Yeah.
So,
would it be necessary that these laws, which are legislated in different parts of the world, to be the same?
No,
because he says it's outside the realm of Sharia anyhow.
Yes.
So you can decide how you want to do it. But if you are enforcing it as laws in an Islamic country, then you have to make sure that it does not contradict the laws of Sharia.
At the same token, if we are living in a non-Islamic country, we should not be saying, okay, well, we're not in an Islamic country, therefore we can follow these laws.
If they contradict Sharia.
If they contradict Sharia.
If they contradict Sharia.
We need that guidance to work with that.
Yeah.
So we're in a double-edged situation.
Yeah, yes.
Isn't it possible that the fatwa of the mujtahid has a social, spatial, and temporal aspect to it as well?
Mm-hmm.
So I can't see the differentiation the thing about here. It could be the second part, which is perhaps something that we consider outside Sharia, which has that aspect.
Mm-hmm.
But then even a fatwa, which is recognized as being within Sharia, would have those aspects as well.
So you are somehow criticizing this division, that even inside the express laws of Sharia, we may have that problem, isn't it? Because they may have a time and space sort of, they may be sensitive to time and space as well, temporal and spatial aspects. And that would somehow put this theory in trouble.
Cannot be applied universally.
Well, it can be applied. I mean, if we don't have this problem, that now, especially nowadays, our problem is not about non-express laws. Our problem is about the express laws of Sharia, isn't it? Now, at that time, he said that, okay, we have no problem. We have express laws. We have to enforce them. These are the rules of Sharia. And then we have areas which are outside this. Sharia is absolutely silent about it. Then we can decide ourselves. Of course, this was a big step because some people did not accept that there are things which are outside the realm of Sharia. Okay? Now, here he says that in these areas we legislate, when we come to express laws of Sharia, we cannot have any say. We have to accept it the way it is. Now, we hear from here that there are temporal, spatial aspects to fatwas as well. That means things which are related to Sharia are somehow affected by time and place, and by situation, and by conditions of people, different conditions that they are in. So we may have that problem. However, let's move on to see how he solves the problem. Of course, we eventually were not going to accept this view anyhow. This is not a view that we are going to accept because of the same problem mentioned. Now, such rules which are bound by time, place, and circumstances, the rules which are outside the realm of Sharia, he assumed that the laws of Sharia are not bound by time, place, and circumstances. This is the assumption. And this is the general assumption of all Muslims, isn't it? That rules of Sharia cannot be affected by time, place, and circumstances. You have to implement it the way the Prophet implemented it. Now, usually when we talk about this, we are talking about social laws, isn't it? Not personal laws or laws of ibadah and these things. We shouldn't
go into those areas. These are not the problematic areas. The problematic areas are laws, penal code, economical regulations, rules and regulations, and such things are the problem-making sort of boundaries of Sharia or elements of Sharia. Now, so such rules which are bound by time, place, and circumstances are formulated through prudence and wisdom of those elected by the people and will be officially recognized and implemented as obligatory once ratified by the majlis and duly endorsed by qualified mujtahids. If they are outside the realm of Sharia, why should they be endorsed by qualified mujtahids? Yes?
To make sure that it is truly out of the Sharia, that the Sharia is not mentioned.
Yeah? That the Sharia is not mentioned it, and that it doesn't contradict with other parts of Sharia. So, it should always be endorsed by qualified mujtahids. Now, one thing, before I come to you, one thing we always have to bear in mind, we are discussing here what the mujtahids should do, not what we have to do. Remember this. Because sometimes when you talk about these issues, as soon as you talk about it, people say, okay, so we have to think about it ourselves. No. We cannot think about it. We are not scholars of this field. We are talking about what the mujtahids should do, not what ordinary people should do. Ordinary people should follow them. That's as simple as that. What the mujtahids, and well, I think I mentioned, this is actually a dispute between mujtahids, not between ordinary people, that what we have to do here. Yes?
Therefore, we have included, we have made it inclusive into Sharia.
You haven't...
You see, here you are first trying to get a law of something that is outside Sharia, and then you are getting Sharia to endorse it. So now it has become included into Sharia. Then why do you want Majlis to duly endorse and then Mujtahid to qualify it if it is outside Sharia?
Because you're defining the premises.
Are you trying to find out whether this should be outside Sharia or inside Sharia by Mujtahid?
Yeah. And also it doesn't contradict Sharia. Isn't it? Sometimes we listen, you know what happens nowadays in Iran, of course, because Iran is trying hard. It's struggling to have a sound system of legislation which doesn't go against Sharia. What happens? The Majlis legislate laws. Because Majlis is consistent of people who are not experts in Sharia, isn't it? They are Mujtahids. Now, they are not aware of implications of this law which somehow contradicts certain aspects of Sharia. That's why it goes to that's a guardian council, which is that five mujtahids which were there are now outside the Majlis, isn't it? They are not outside the Majlis, and they veto. Okay? And they, for example, they explain this, the implication of this article of the law is in contradiction with this law of Sharia, so they return it and they have to modify. So this is why you need that, yes.
If Sayyid Sistani has told us to obey the laws of Islam, then does that make me obeying traffic codes part of Sharia?
Does it? I mean, this is a good question. Does it? Does it make, if for example, Sayyid Sistani says you have to follow the laws of the land, does it make the traffic laws part of Sharia?
Has Sayyid Sistani redefined the premises? Has he moved everything from non-express laws into express laws and just delegated it out?
Come on. Tell me. So, does it make it part of Sharia? Well, actually, no, it doesn't make it part of Sharia. That means any law that they legislate in the parliament, Westminster, which does not contradict Sharia, is a law of religion, is a law of Sharia, isn't it? It is not. So, the only thing is that he just says follow the laws of the land. That's all. It doesn't mean laws of the land are laws of Sharia. This one particular injunction is law of Sharia, that follow the laws of the land. That's it. And also, here, now, there are actually, it's very interesting because during these 30 years in Iran, there have been such disputes as well. Exactly the same thing that you say, that any law legislated by parliament in Iran is a law of Sharia. And therefore, if, for example, you violate the traffic lights, not only you get a ticket, you will be sent to hell as well. So, it's a double implication. And even if you are not afraid of the ticket and you are very rich, you are afraid of the hell, isn't it? But this is very extreme. It's very extreme to say that whatever is legislated is part of Sharia. Because it's endorsed by this mujtahid. It's endorsed by the mujtahid in the sense that they do not contradict the laws of Sharia. In this system.
While we're exploring this thing, what happens when there's a conflict between the Sharia and the law of the land? What is our responsibility then?
Well, that's a very difficult situation, of course, when there is like, for example, if they do not allow that you have halal slaughtering, for example, and you have to eat the haram food, or they do not allow hijab, isn't it? Mujtahid would say that you should not stay in those countries which would not allow you to practice your religion freely. But certainly there are certain aspects in every society that we cannot run away from it. I mean, like, for example, riba in this country. You cannot run away from it. You may not use it, but you are part of the system. You use the banks and all these things. So it's very difficult sometimes. Anyhow, if there is a contradiction in that way, or if they do not allow you practice, then the ulama say you should leave, or something like that. Of course, there are some ulama who say you have to stay and try to change the law. You have to stay and fight legally, not, of course, fight violently. Fight legally for your rights. Ayatollah Makarem, I read that there was an istiftah from him about hijab in France, that the schools did not allow hijab. Inside the school, they couldn't wear hijab. And they asked, what is our responsibility? What should we do? Should we leave the country? Now, the answer was, and this is a very interesting answer, a very typical answer. No other mujtahid I have seen giving such an answer. The answer was that they should wear hijab as much as possible, or as far as possible. I mean, if they come to the door of the school and they have to take their hijab, let them do that, but do not leave the land. Because you have to stay there and change the law. This land does not belong only to others. It belongs to you as well. So you have to stay there, and you have to become strong legally so that you fight for your laws. This is one opinion as well. Other opinions is just you have to leave if you cannot practice that. Okay. I think it's clear anyhow. We may not accept certain opinions, but it's very clear what he says. Now, this view was taken up by Allama Tabatabai almost verbatim in some of his books, because he has dealt with this issue as well. Allama Tabatabai was a very bright personality, actually. And although he was deep in his knowledge of Irfan and Tafsir and philosophy, but he wrote on many issues which were very sensitive in his time, like, for example, about Marxism, materialism, and also about how we have to deal with changes in society and how we can make compromise between that and, of course, the laws of Sharia. And he also brings the idea of waliya, that there are certain things which is up to waliya amr to decide. And when waliya amr decides it is legal, it is according to Sharia, you can follow it, you can't say that this is a legislation which has come from not from Sharia, so why I should follow it? You see, there is also this mentality among some of the Muslims as well, that they don't have this sense of society. They always think individually. For example, they say, okay, these laws which are legislated in Muslim countries, they do not come from God. Why should I follow it? I can violate it, I can break it. Allah is not going to punish me. And I do it in a way that they cannot punish me as well. So, why should I do that? Now, here, Na'ini Allah Ta'ala Tabari, they say that when these laws are endorsed by Wali Amr, you cannot break them. Now, you cannot break them not in the sense that they are part of Sharia, but in the sense that these are as-siyasatun nawiyyah, these are policies made by Islamic government, and you have to follow those policies made by the Islamic government. Now, of course, we always have strange people thinking like that. I mean, there was someone in Iran, he used to break the law, I don't want to mention name or whatever, and he used to say, I follow a different mujtahid than what you, your mujtahid in God and Council endorsed these laws. I follow a different mujtahid. But this man didn't have a sense of society at all, how society works. You cannot live with your own individual rule in a society. It's not possible. Okay. Now, we come to Mutahhari's view. Mutahhari was by far more sort of surrounded by questions from different groups of people about Sharia and laws of Sharia, especially in that very secular society of the time of the Shah, and he tried to find a solution. He did not actually accept the idea of expressed and non-expressed. He said that whatever we legislate, it is mainly in the realm of Sharia. I mean, because there are always, always aspects which somehow touch the boundaries of Sharia. And therefore, we cannot say that we have laws outside and inside, and then we think about what's outside and what's inside. And especially that problem, which we discussed, we're not talking about those areas which are outside Sharia. We are talking about the areas which are inside Sharia and they need change. That is the problem. We don't have the problem with traffic laws or laws of maritime navigation or the laws of space. We don't have problem with that. We have problem with laws which are inside Sharia and we cannot implement them. Easily we cannot implement them. Now let me mention one example. One example, and then we come to what Mutahhari says, because this example gives us a better idea. You know, according to Islamic Sharia, in economy, if two parties want to make a contract with each other freely, with their own volition, while they are both sane and sure, no one can step in and set conditions for them. I, for example, as a person, want to hire someone, and that someone is sane and mature, comes forth, I say, these are my conditions. He says, okay, these are my conditions. We agree. No third party can step in and say, well, wait here. I don't like this sort of agreement. You have to set a condition here as well. Except, of course, all conditions should be according to Sharia. Shouldn't violate the laws of Sharia. Now, when we come to modern society, we have this huge workforce, working class, who are absolutely dispossessed, so to speak. And then we have capitalists, big people of big wealth, big capital, and they, when they want to employ these poor people, they can set any condition inside the realm of Sharia. Okay, I want you to work 10 hours a day. I don't give you any leave in the weekends. No pension, nothing. Do you agree? No, I don't agree. Okay, you go, step aside. There's a queue here. There are people who are more destitute than you. They come, they want to be employed. Now, the contract they make is absolutely shaggy. Can government step in and say, wait a moment, this man is destitute, that's why he's accepting it. So I impose certain conditions here. If you want to employ any one of these dispossessed people, they shouldn't work more than 8 hours. You have to give them leave on weekends. You have to give them insurance, pension, all these things. And he said, wait a moment, you are violating Sharia, you are stepping in my contract with them. So what to do with this? What is the law of Sharia? The Sharia, the traditional Sharia, tells us, you cannot intervene. And this was a big problem, you know. This Employment Act, which was being legislated in Iranian parliament, it took 2 years because of this problem. Because the government council said, how can we impose this on employers? It's against Sharia. We employ something, we enforce something, we implement something against one party in the benefit of another party. How can we do it? Now, the Majlis used to say, well, babies, it's absolutely rational, it's absolutely humane that we have to protect these people. Now, what's your opinion? What is your opinion? Well, of course, I know. Your heart says, of course we have to support those poor human beings. But your Sharia aspect of mind says, well, we cannot violate Sharia, isn't it? This is Sharia. Yes?
I think in an Islamic environment, in an Islamic state, there has to be certain, as you said, certain rights which are given to individuals. So when contracts are being made, these rights need to be stipulated.
Based on what?
Based on Sharia, obviously.
Which Sharia?
In Islamic state. So obviously, in an Islamic state, you can't have any kind of oppressive, laws, anything which goes against justice, as it were. But
isn't it justice that two individuals freely want to enter into a contract?
Yeah, that's fine. Yes, as long as those individuals freely enter into the contract.
Yeah, they are freely entering into the contract.
They give up their right.
What right? They have the right just to agree with the contract, isn't it? What right? What other right?
But you're allowed to do that anyway, as I understand. I mean, Islam allows you to do that anyway.
To exploit people?
It's like the husband and wife. I mean, there is a general law there, but the husband and wife can also agree outside of that and stipulate whatever condition they have, and they would then be part of the contract.
Yeah,
but
the government cannot step in and say, if you want to marry, I want to set another condition above, on top of whatever conditions you set, isn't it?
No.
Of course, now they are doing it.
My point is, let's say that the employer and the employee both are happy.
Yeah, both are happy. Yeah, that's what the employer said. He says, we are both happy.
Not like you said, like the employer is saying, if you don't want it, I can get somebody else. But both parties are happy to go into it.
What do you mean?
It
depends on the person's circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm really destitute, I'm happy with any condition you set, isn't it? You have the money, you have the power, I don't have anything, you set conditions, I say, okay, I want. Because if I don't take it, someone else takes it. Someone who is in more need, isn't it? Yes.
But that's why it goes back to when you said sane and rational. The government's assuming that, or when the government sets conditions, it's assuming that these people aren't sane and rational because of their poverty or their need or whatever. So it's putting certain conditions there.
No, no,
they are. If they were sane and rational,
of course. There is a definition of being sane and rational, isn't it? I mean, sane and rational doesn't mean that if you are poor, you are insane. That's what that is every poor person should be insane. Thank you very much, because I'm poor. No, I'm joking. Yes, sir.
The principle of Islam al-Ummah, right? I mean, the greater good, the prayers. In this case, for the greater good, it is the majority benefit from it. And when the majority, it is the nature of the majority of the nation, then, of course, this will prevail against narrower definitions.
Yes, but, you know, to establish this in jurisprudence is very difficult. I mean, it's a value, okay. But when you come to legislation, to laws, you come to usul al-fiqh, you come to fiqh, you come to traditions, it's very difficult to tackle this. However, you are right. I mean, we have greater values that we have to take into consideration. Just that rigid. Now, you see, rigid laws of Sharia, we are not talking about that, isn't it? That Sharia that I mentioned, that laws of Sharia, it's very rigid, isn't it? It says that, well, you have to. And it works in certain circumstances. I mean, in old days, it worked in certain circumstances. Nowadays, as I said, because you have huge factories, you have production lines and all these things, and people are just waiting to get some food. Now, don't look at the modern society because they have set all these conditions on employers, and now, of course, we live in a sort of relatively just system in this respect. However, think about a couple of centuries ago when Marx was not there to criticize capitalism, and capitalism was not trying to struggle to survive, and of course they haven't done all these out of benefaction and goodwill for the workforce or for workers. They have done it in struggle of survival of capitalism. But it was good. I mean, they fought against each other and the people had some benefits. Now, almost what, of course, we had as a suggestion that we have greater good that we have to bear in mind in Sharia. Ayatollah Mutahhari has almost the same view. He says that, you see, we have laws of Sharia, we have other laws of Sharia which overrule them, we have other bigger values which overrule those, so we always have to judge. Now, again, when I say we mean Mujtahids. You see, don't again try to bring this to your family saying, okay, my child, you deserve this. What do you want to do? Now, we are talking about Mujtahids deciding and trying to do it. Now, as I said, Mutahhari formulates the problem as follows. The problem with the issue of Islam and time exigencies is the problem of coexistence and coordination between two objects that are against each other in their natures. Of the two, one is fixed and irrevocable in nature, while the other is revocable and fluid. So, he criticizes the axiom, this axiom, that Islam is fixed, Sharia is fixed, and so society is fixed. So he says neither Islam is absolutely fixed, so he accepts some sort of flexibility here in Sharia. No society is absolutely fluid. There are certain principles, certain elements in every society which are constant. I mean, can we imagine that comes a time that we say loving is good? It's constant. We cannot say everything in society changes. We may say, of course, many values change, but there are certain, well, who knows? Nowadays, everything is changing. Who knows, maybe one day, if we say homosexuality is good, then lying is easy to say that lying is good as well. So, anyhow, Islam has fixed and transient factors, and society has fixed and transient elements. And therefore, the solution lies in the Islamic legal system itself. He says that Islamic legal system in itself has provided us with the solution. We don't need to look anywhere else. And that solution lies in a couple of premises. He says Islam has a mechanism inside its legal system which ignites internal changes of its own without the need of any person to bring about such a change. So now we are talking about change inside Sharia. We're not talking about non-express laws. So just forget about what Naini said, that's old. Come to the new system here, that now we are talking about changes inside the realm of Sharia. However, he says that this change is legal, Sharia, permissible, and this the mechanism for this change is provided by Sharia itself, actually. So we are not worried about changing society, because Sharia can tell us how you can fix the law to go with the changes in Sharia. Of course, you know, Mutahhari was somehow criticized by the more traditional quarters of the clergy. And sometimes they regarded him to be absolutely outside the mainstream. However, I mean, a personality like Imam Khomeini absolutely endorsed all his thoughts. So that means that there was a sort of quarter inside the traditional system of clergy who endorsed his views. Now, through explaining this mechanism, Mutahhari makes it clear that he supports the third option. What was the third option we mentioned? To expand the boundaries of Sharia, to explore the new areas of Sharia. And actually, according to, as the time goes by, we will have bigger and bigger Sharia, so to speak. That is, to push the boundaries of Sharia to make it bigger. This is the real meaning of Ijtihad, he says. He says, Ijtihad is not just going over and over again and again of what other people have tried and found out about Salat and Fast and these things. The real Ijtihad is to find out laws. You remember last week we said that Ijtihad has two sides. One is, what did Prophet do? That was one aspect. The other one, what would Prophet have done if he was in this situation? This is the other part. And this is the main subject of Ijtihad, actually.
How does it deal with what you said earlier, in the sense that, just to turn up with this analogy of traffic lights, you said that, you know, certainly we don't expect to do it now because we didn't reach out the light.
Yeah.
So now we're saying we're widening Sharia, and by widening Sharia we're saying that
yeah.
We're encompassing law to law, basically.
Yeah.
No.
There are certain things which are completely outside that realm of Sharia. Okay, we accept that. However, he talks about bringing change inside the realm of Sharia. Traffic light is outside the realm of Sharia. We don't worry about that. But we need changes like what I said. This employment law. Employment. This is something which is very closely in conflict with the Sharia law. If we want to legislate the law supporting the workers, the employee, then it conflicts with the law of Sharia. He says, we do not agree with in such a conflict. We think that by Ijtihad we can resolve this. That is actually the main difference. By Ijtihad we can resolve the issue. So, the system, the strange system of Sharia, which he mentions, the strange system of Sharia which he mentions here is that, first of all, the rulings of Sharia are of general nature and do not pertain to specific events. They say, or in the Usuli sort of jargon, he says, they are legislated as qadaya haqiqiyya, not qadaya waqiyya. What is it? It's a general premise. It says anyone in such situation should do such. Not that such and such persons, X and Y, should do this. If it was like that, it was very difficult to be flexible. It talks about situations, hypothetical individuals, that if they were in such situations, then these laws would have applied. So, the second thing is that certain rules may come to contradiction with each other. Okay, remember the example. Justice and the law of Sharia, free contract. Okay, now, certain rules may come to contradiction with each other at any time. That is, occasionally doing something can be obligatory as much as forbidden at the same time. Now, because it's qazaya haqiqiya, he says anyone in such situation should do this, anyone in the other situation should do that, and one person may be caught in both situations. I'll give you the example now. The example he gives is this. This is a very cliche example they give. Okay, saving life is obligatory. Saving life of other people. If you see someone is dying, it's obligatory that you save them, if you can. This is one qadhiya haqiqiya, a general law. Anyone seeing someone else dying and can help, they should help save the life. Okay. Again, you have another qadhiya, another premise. That anyone whose male cannot touch a female person, cannot touch the body of a female person. Now, you are caught in a situation that a female person is dying and you want to help and you have to touch her. You see, you are caught in a situation where both these premises apply to your situation. In the sense that there is one obligatory rule and one forbidden rule, and they conflict with each other, isn't it? So, for example, a lady is drowning in the swimming pool or whatever in the sea, and you are passing by, and she is calling for help. Now, what do? Do you go and help? Can I do that? Can I touch that lady and help her? Now, your, of course, common sense. What does your common sense say? Say that. Why? These are two different rules of Sharia, isn't it? Why do you say that you have to say that?
Sharia is not a level playing field, it's a hierarchy of rules.
There's a huge difference between the two, isn't it? One is much more important than the other. Now, do you get what he wants to take us to? Wants to take us to a situation where when we have conflict, we have to think which one is more important. What is more important? Now, come back to that example of the Employment Act. Yes?
Let me just ask a very simple question. Who decided what?
That is actually what we want to come to at the end of this discussion. As I said, we are talking about Mushahid, okay?
Yeah. I mean, within which states, is there a premises on which it is based?
And you really, these examples are very simple. I mean, it's straightforward. But we come to examples where it's not as straightforward as that. It's very difficult to decide. Very difficult to decide. And who wants to decide? And we come to that. That's what we are actually trying to arrive at later next week, inshallah. As I said, I just tuned the pace in a way that we have the discussion to consider next week as well. So he says that it's quite understandable that in such situations we take the bigger course and leave the smaller course. So, in such cases, it's advisable to follow the rule which is more important and ignore the one that is less important. And actually, most of the problem we have with the laws of Sharia today is similar to this. We have certain values which are advised by Sharia, by Islam, not Sharia traditionally, and it comes to conflict with the laws of Sharia. You see? That is the problem. And we have to solve it. And of course, the major, major issue is who wants to decide. It is very difficult. It's very difficult. And this is what I wanted to actually bring to our attention. Can one man tackle? It's not about simple issues that you, for example, a marja can just issue a fatwa about certain things. No. Can one man really decide what is more important, what's less important? Or we need support. We need support from other sectors of society to support that one man or whatever to decide what is more important, what's less important. And we need a mechanism to decide what is more important, what is less, rather than just an individual discussion. Now, in such cases, it's advisable to, of course, follow the rule which is more important and ignore the one which is less important. And, of course, he brings this axiom, إِذَا اجْتَمَعَتِ الْحُرْمَتَانِ طُرَحَتِ الصُّغْرَى لِلْكُبْرَى. This is the usuli principle. If two laws, حُرْمَتَان means two laws, come in contradiction, you just discard the less important one for the more important one. Therefore, people's duties may differ in the course of time by which Sharia rulings would differ as well. So, Sharia, now this is what, of course, the traditional ulama would have come out against Mutahari. Sharia in our time may be one thing, in a couple of centuries ago may have been something different, in a couple of centuries later may be something different. This is what he is actually trying to take us to.
Isn't that where the ruling was applied for Tibet?
That was something temporary. That was something temporary, wasn't it? It wasn't a political sort of fatwa. But yes, we can say that. Yes, at that time, the marja says the consumption of tobacco is haram, and everyone should follow, for example. But these are more problematic than that. You see, at that time, because foreign powers were using tobacco to subdue Muslims, yes, that bigger law or bigger value came in and made tobacco consumption haram. But temporarily, however, we have things which are not as temporary as that. It may somehow drag on for longer. Yes?
When he says Sharia, he's talking about the Sharia prescribed by the Mujtahids, not the Sharia of Allah. He's not saying the Sharia of Allah changes over time.
It should mean the Sharia of Mujtahids is different from Sharia of Allah.
The Sharia of Mujtahids is just the Mujtahids trying to interpret what is the Sharia of Allah. Was the Sharia of Allah, is that set by Allah? It's the system of life of Allah.
But do we have access to that Sharia of Allah?
Isn't that what Ijtihad is supposed to be helping us understand?
So it's two Mujtahids, isn't it? We don't have access to Sharia of Allah, actually. It's all based on Ijtihad, isn't it? So it's all Ijtihad. We say, to the best of our efforts and understanding, this is what we understand that the Sharia of Allah is, isn't it? Yes.
When it comes to the hierarchy of principles, hierarchy of rules, the Ayatollah you just mentioned about the hijab ban, when he said, remove your hijab and stay in your country. Is he making the assumption that the ruling of staying in your country, the principle of changing the country to become more Islamic, is more important,
isn't it?
Okay.
He is actually trying to say that. And of course, he thinks this is something temporary. If you stay there and you fight for your rights, you can obtain it. That's what he is thinking about. So, yeah, Sharia may be different, and of course it's Mujtahideen who decide what is Sharia at every time. So when we talk about Sharia, we talk about Sharia which is obtained by Ijtihad. Now, do you agree that Sharia may be different at different times?
I think it's comprehended, because if I'm not mistaken, there were certain rulings of Mahoma Ayatollah Khui, where originally when he released his Tawzi'. And then in the later stages, maybe through more research or more finding out, he has made certain changes.
But that was actually mentioned before.
When people follow, so if I died following the first Tawzi, and by the time my son came in, the Tawzi had the same fatwa, had a different ruling, and he followed it differently.
No, but that doesn't mean Sharia change. That means his view changed. And he made up for his mistakes, probably.
It's a ruling. It's a ruling that the Ummah followed. And Allah Mustad at that time, one of the, in fact, you say.
So we are saying that this is one of the instances where we can say Sharia is different at different times.
Because we are relying on the ijtihad of that individual.
Yeah, but we are talking about deeper issues, actually. Not things which are made up for one's neglect or something like that. Things which are actually based on good arguments, non-negligence, not something like that. And people think that this is something that we have to have now as opposed to what we had in the past. Yes, sister.
We have to follow the spirit of the Lord. Not the letter of the law, unless otherwise stated specifically.
Mm-hmm.
That is dangerous.
The spirit of the law, not letter of the law. So we do not follow the letter of Sharia, is what you say. So for example, if Allah says that you have to lash the fornicator 100 times, you say, okay, it means to punish.
No, unless otherwise stated, as in the Quran.
Then you have to speak. What does it say in Hadith? You see, we have problems still. You see, you cannot somehow
we have
emphasize on letters. And, what is explicitly stated, you are going back to 90s people, isn't it? Explicitly stated and not explicitly stated. Yes.
This is when we are saying primarily what is Quran and Sunnah is the foundation.
Yes.
Here we are discussing certain rulings that were not applicable in the time of the Prophet. So what would have the Prophet done?
And it comes into conflict with what Prophet did.
Well, if it did, then it is overridden, isn't it? Which is the greater of the
You see, what if what Prophet would have done come into conflict with what Prophet did?
Okay.
that's the problem. You see, that's the problem. Yes.
every parliament around the world, every system of law around the world. Well, as far as I know, functions by a rule where current parliaments can override the rules of the past.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why if the system of Sharia changes, then that means that the present English states can override the rules of the past English states.
Mm-hmm.
And what they said today can override what they said yesterday.
Yeah, in secular law you can say that, but we are talking about a law which is based on tradition from the Prophet and the Quran.
The principle by which these parliaments function is that society changes, so
yeah.
The circumstances change.
Mm-hmm.
So in your example where what the Prophet did one thing, and the question is whether the Prophet would have done something else. The fact that he would have had these two options means that the situation is different from the time of the Prophet.
Yeah.
Because we have these two options.
Yeah.
Which means that we can't use those examples in this scenario.
Yeah, but this is what we are saying, actually. Isn't it? But would ulama accept this? Would ulama say that this is permissible? Can we actually somehow intrude into the realm of written Sharia? Can we do that? And that's the main issue.
It isn't an intrusion.
Hmm?
It isn't an intrusion at all. It's something completely different. Because we have another possibility, we have another option that
okay.
could have chosen from.
Okay,
so
okay. We'll
now.
Come to this next week, inshallah. We'll come to this. Yes, sir. No.
Just very brief, because obviously it's coming up to the time. So, in an ideal situation, if the Imam was present right now, everything would become under Sharia. Yes.
Yeah.
Now, in the absence of the Imam at the moment, the Imam's instructions are very clear. Follow the Mujtahid.
You see, there's no problem. Yeah, that's good.
So
we follow the Mujtahid. Yeah.
So my question is very simple. If all the Mujtahidin can come to a consensus that there is one Adam at the moment who you should follow, it's very clear for all of us, the whole world should follow. Yeah, so it's not that case, and I don't think it's going to be that case for a long time. So in the absence of that, the Imam's words are still clear that those that are knowledgeable amongst you, that are the highest in ranking, should be followed. So let's say there's 10 who are the highest in ranking.
Yeah.
Let's say there's 9 of them in Iran. Okay? I'm just assuming. So let's say there's 9 of them in Iran. Whatever laws are passed, whether it be through parliament, whether it be through, has to go through these people, because they have to verify this, because it's only the Imam who's guiding them. He's given the guarantee that he's going to guide them. So it's the Imam who's guiding them. He's not guiding every Dominic and Harry who's passing laws.
Sorry, the Imam guiding who?
He said that he's going to guide them. He's there. He's the authority over them. And they are the authority over
you. You know, this is a very strange assumption that the Imam is guiding Mujtahids.
Well, that's what he said, that he's the authority over them.
Yeah, he's authority.
They are the authority over you.
Yeah, authority in the sense that they have to refer to his traditions. Not that he guides them, because if we believe that he guides them, then
we have examples of that where Mujtahidin have made mistakes in the past and the Imam has guided them.
That's very rare.
We have realistic.
We don't have any example of that in our contemporary time.
You're going back to a little while back. So the last one was the burial of Tanya, where the mother was married with the child.
This is 1,000 years ago, isn't it?
I think the confusion is that our past teachers reference this narration specifically. Next week, would you be able to just explain what this narration means?
Yes.
Exactly what it means. What does it mean? It says, here's your first.
Yes, inshallah. Okay, you remind me, inshallah, we'll discuss that. Yeah. Sorry, time is up.